Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chapter 21 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, entitled How Time Goes By. So we've just looked at sundials, now we're going to look at the actual monitoring of time as set out by the sun. As usual, there's two quotes to start off with. Leopold Bloom, which is a fictitious character in Ulysses. Somewhere in the east, early morning, set off at dawn, travel around in front of the sun, steal a day's march on him, keep up forever, never grow a day older, technically. That is, so if you were sort of thinking of solar synchronous orbit, I'm about to sneeze. In the Taming of the Shrew by Shakespeare. Now, I remember the last time Shakespeare, I think, with sundials and clocks, he got this wrong, but in the Taming of the Shrew, Petruchio, it shall be what o'clock I say it is, or 10 the zone. Why? So this gallant will command the sun. It's an interesting point about people determining what the time is by common. It's a declared knowledge, but also it's a crossover between declared knowledge and actual. It's declared how we're going to interpret things, I think is the actual thing. In the early 1960s, my father retired from his family firm to run a pub in Cornwall. During the school holidays, I would work alongside him twice each day, at 2:30 in the afternoon, again at 11 in the evening, in keeping with his licensing laws, whereby pubs had to close first for 3 hours and then again for nearly 12 hours until reopening at 10:30 the following morning. He would intone in his brasso profondo, "Time, gentlemen, please." It was a peculiar social ritual, a polite command to stop drinking that had the feel of a technological pronouncement. A theological pronouncement, sorry. That's a thought, a thing. A theology. Oh, I think it's knowledge, study of knowledge. Patrons who know they had a minute or two to drink up. In contrast to the 60 seconds of silence imposed by the English teacher at the end of his classes, which we so long to be over, the hardened local stretches out every last moment of tippling as long as they could, for the announcement was never welcome. As Oliver Sir John Gogarty, 1878 to 1975, the Irish poet who inspired the character of Bal Mulliken in Ulysses wrote. So here's the thing. No wonder stars are winking, no wonder heaven mocks at men who cease the drinking good booze because of clocks. It makes me wonder whether, in this grim pantomime, did friend or man first blether. Time, gentlemen, time. Okay, now, the modern history of pub, this is a footnote, the pub restrictions in Britain began with DORA, the Defence of the Realm Act, passed in the First World War to reduce the hangovers among workers in munition factories. And then, this is, has to be said, in the there were hangovers and absenteeism in our munition factories as well. Time has continued to vex mankind since the beginning of, well, the world is difficult to avoid. And the complexities that feed mankind's subjective experiences of time versus our objective measurements, and the possibility of ever reconciling the two. Anthony Burgess hints at this in the essay Thoughts on Time. In the first great flush of the establishment of universal public time, Greenwich Mean Time Reckoning, there were certain works of imagination said something about the double reality of time. Oscar Wilde wrote, "The Picture of Dorian Gray, in which the hero transfers public time as well as public morality to his portrait while he himself, residing in private time, is motionless. The experience of the time during both the First and Second World Wars was of a new kind to the average participant. The start of battles had to rely on public time, but soldiers lived on inner time, the eternity's apprehension that were really going on only a minute long, the deserts of boredom, or the terror that was outside time. Time as experienced subjectively may indeed be mysterious. In the Iliad, its quantity has a value for the victory and another quantity for the vanquished. St. Augustine said sourly that he knew what time it was until he was asked to explain it. No matter how it's passed, it's the sun that determines time, and our employment of that guiding star to monitor time's passing as between the most pervasive of all the ways in which civilization harnesses the sun. It has ever been critical for two groups, astronomers and navigators, to measure the time with precision. But throughout Christian world, it has been the church that has provided the main impetus towards timekeeping. Much of the same is true of the Muslims and the Jews. Islam requires the faithful to pray five times a day, Judaism three. Christians would pray according to the movements of the heavens, and it was Saint Benedict who, in his rule in AD 530, laid out the exact times of devotion. Matins, Lords, there you have placed a tent for the sun. It comes forth like a champion to run its course. Prime, first, trees, third, sixth, none, ninth hour, which survives through 3 hours, back-timed as noon, vespers and compline. Lords and vespers, the services of sunrise and sunset, are specifically sun-related, while the others are linked to set hours. This timetable was widely adopted, so much so that Pope Sabinus of 605-6 proclaimed that church bells should ring to mark the passing of the hours. In the years that followed, a large number of forms of civil life became regulated by the punctuality. So it's the prayers got into the bells, then got into commerce. It's pretty interesting. Well, it's Kevin Jackson. Quote, became a new obsession. Constant research into timekeeping mechanisms eventually resulted in the making of clocks. After the Middle Ages, from roughly 1270 to 1520, by far the best-selling volume throughout Europe was not the Bible, but the Book of Hours, a guide to Benedict's rule. During these years, the practice was maintained of defining 1 hour as the 12th part of the day and night. So that's interesting, that the hour is not what we thought is a passage of time, but the division of a day. So in summertime, daylight hours were longer than those of darkness, the opposite being true in winter, custom ending only when the newly invented mechanical clock, with its uniform motion duplicating that of the heavens, gradually made people familiar with the mean solar way of measuring used by astronomers. Mechanical clocks, driven by weights and gears, would seem to have been the invention of the 11th century Arab engineer who had introduced and were introduced in England around 1270 in experimental form. First clocks, regular use in Europe, for which we have sure evidence, were those made by Roger Stoke of Norwich Cathedral, 1321-5, and by Giovanni Dori of Padua, whose 1 meter high construction of 1364, with astrolabe and calendar dials and indicators of the sun, moon, and planets, provided a continuous display of the major elements of the Earth's center solar system. And for legal religious calendars, the clocks were made not to show the time, but to sound it. The very word clock comes from the Latin word bell, cloca, cloaca. And the hour machine for years had been known as a horlog, or hour tower, separate. Although medieval striking clocks were thoughtfully designed to remain silent at night, this device, Daniel Borson notes, was a new kind of public utility, offering a service each citizen could not afford to provide himself. People unwittingly recognised a new era when, noting the time of day and night, they said, "It's 9 o'clock, the time of the clock." Shakespeare's characters mentioned the time of the clock. They recalled the hour they had heard it last struck. In 1504, after a boar which a man killed at Nuremberg, locksmith Peter Henriksen sought sanctuary in a monastery, staying there for several years, during which time he invented a portable clock, the first watch devised as the Nuremberg Chronicles of 511 record, quote, "With very many wheels, this horologia, in any position and without any weight, both indicate and strike for 40 hours, even when carried in the breast of or in the purse. Yet, until well into the century, people had to set their timepieces according to the shifting sunrise of the day and stop to adjust them every time they were caught running fast or slow. The expected accuracy was no better than the nearest 15 minutes. Tycho Brahe's clocks typically had just an hour hand. Cardinal Richelieu was showing off his collection of clocks when a visitor knocked two on the floor. Quite dismayed, the Cardinal observed, "That's the first time they've gone off together." Towards the end of the 16th century, the Swiss clockmaker Josse Bellou constructed a piece that could be marked the seconds as well as minutes. But that, observes Lisa Jardin, was one-off and difficult to reproduce. The reliable second measurements had to wait for another 100 years. That probably is an exaggeration. By 1670, minute hands were common, and an average error for best timepieces had been reduced to be at 10 seconds a day. The now minute derives from pars minuta prima, the first tiny part. It is the English language around 1600. The second comes from pars minuta seconda. By 1860, it was common for both minutes and seconds to appear. Both chronology and time clocks soon became a fashion, even fetish. Louis XIV had not one clockmaker, but four, along with their armory of devices, accompanied him in his progresses. Courtiers at Versailles were expected to order their days at fixed times of the sun's king's rising, and his prayers, council meetings, meals, walks, hunts, concerts. One of the six classes of French nobility were the noblesse de cloque, the nobility of the bell, largely drawn from mayors and large towns, the bell being the embodiment of municipal authority. That's really interesting. Bing! Timepieces were exact enough that philosophers from Descartes to Paley took the use of clocks as a metaphor for perfection of the divine creation. Lilliput's commissioner, this is obviously in Gulliver's Travels, Lilliput's commissioner reports on Lemuel Gulliver's watch, quote, "We think it is his god because he consults it all the time." With both Frederick the Great and the hero of Trafalgar and Navarro Admiral Cordigan having their pocket watches smashed by enemy fire, it seems the mark of eminent commanders up at the sharp end to have their accessories thus shattered. In order to meet the new demand for individual timepieces, quote, not only watches, but clocks small enough to fit into the modest house of a craftsman's workshop, clockmakers were forced to become pioneers in the creation of scientific instruments. Their products, for instance, required precision screws, which in turn necessitated improvement of the machine metal age. The mechanical revolution of the 19th century was the result in large part of ordinary people's wish to tell the time for themselves. And yet, the continue to be holdouts, even in the 20th century. Virginia Woolf and Mrs. Dalloway lets out an almost cry of pain at the ubiquity of the clock. Okay. Shredding and slicing, dividing and subdividing, the clocks of Harley Street nibbled at the June day, counselling submission, upheld authority, and pointed out the chorus of supreme advantage of a sense of proportion, until the mounds of time were far diminished that the commercial clocks suspended above the shop of Oxford Street announced, genially and fraternally, as if it were a pleasure to Messrs. Rigby and Lowndes to give the information gratis that it was 1:30. What a beautiful set of phrase. I hope I'm improving. Okay, this is what when in 1834 the clock was commissioned as part of the rebuilding of the fire-gutted Palace of Westminster. The government called for a noble clock, indeed the king of clocks, the biggest in the world has ever seen, within sight of the throbbing heart of London. The astronomers royal further insisted that it should be accurate within a second. The outcome was Big Ben, strictly speaking, the bell, finally completed in 1859. So a fair time after. Once people could tell the exact time, and what time were they telling? There were so many to choose from. From 1848, the United Kingdom had become the first country in the world to standardize the time across the entire territory to the single Greenwich Observatory, with Dublin mean time just over 25 minutes behind. That year saw the publication of Dumley and Son, in which distraught Mr. Dumley complains there was even a railway time observed by clocks, as if the sun had given him. In 1890, Dr. Watson records was travelling the train in the Sherlock Holmes on a case in the West Country, which, being startled by the master gauging minute fluctuations in the train velocity by timing the telegraph poles set at standard 60-yard intervals as they flash past their windows. Well, this would be the with the train acting as the sun, the poles as longitude, a powerful image in a way in which the concept of standardisation of time insinuated itself into people's consciousness. Not everyone, of course. Oscar Wilde, 1854 to 1900, once arrived exceptionally late for dinner. His hostess pointed angrily at the clock on the wall, saying, "Mr. Wilde, you are aware what time it is?" "My dear lady," Wilde explained, "I pray tell me, how can that nasty machine possibly know what the great golden orb is up to?" But it did. Einstein, of course, tells us there's no such thing as absolute time. Salutary to recall that offices were, where he worked, were for so long a clearinghouse for patents on the synchronisation of clocks, and that he himself recalled, "At the time when I established how clocks function..." Yes, honey? Okay. Okay, returning after a little break. I hope slightly better reading, just having listened to the last bit that I've read. So, reading that last paragraph again, Einstein, of course, tells us there's no such thing as absolute time. Salutary to recall that the office where he worked was for so long the clearinghouse of patents for the synchronisation of clocks. And he himself recalled, "At the time when I was establishing how clocks functioned, I was finding the utmost difficulty in keeping a clock in my room." Okay, so there's a asterisk here. Similarly, the sound and the fury, Faulkner has the Harvard student Quentin, desperate to escape civil time, shatters his pocket watch. "Because father said clocks slay time," he said. "Time is dead as long as it's clicked off by little wheels. Only when the clock stops does time come to life." Others have found the very ticking of a clock a thing of solace. T.E. Lawrence, tried down and viciously lashed by Turkish captors during the Great War, yet he notes somewhere in the place a cheap clock ticked loudly, and it distressed me that their beating was not in its time. Oh, they were beating him. Oh, isn't that amazing? Of course, I have my own little clock ticking inside my heart. This is a mechanical ticker. And so you go in and you go into a quiet room, you hear a clock tick. You try and look for it, and then you realise it's yourself. You can hear the echo inside. Okay, continues to read. "While the sun appeared to have been replaced, in fact, it continued to hold sway throughout the civilised world. Even in the mid-19th century, the towns and cities of most countries still had individual sun-based systems of timekeeping. Every French city, for instance, held to its own local time, taken from the reading of the sun at its equally local zenith. The time bowed down to space. There was nothing that God had given in the starting point of a second or a minute or an hour. The result was the prospect of a globe united by telegraph. Fast trains, steamships had so far been stalled because the spinning, angled earth and the apparent moving sun made nonsense of the idea of universal time. The clock on the wall told the hour for the family. The clock in the town hall told the hour for the citizenry. But on the other side of the hill, clocks were strangers. The imposition of universal time standards might be been dangerous. Field Marshal Helmut von Moltke, 1800 to 1891, headed the Prussian, then German army for nearly 30 years, lobbied for the unitary time system of Germany as an aid to making trains run on time, so that his troops might be mobilised more effectively, but it was opposed by those who feared that an integrated rail system would provoke Russia to invade. Nevertheless, it was becoming obvious that the uniformity could not be put off indefinitely. Quote, "Societies are moving faster than their ability to measure," said the historian Clark Bayes puts it. Writing on the First World War, when wristwatches came into common use, they were much favoured by centuries, obviously, you want to see. Burgess says, It was a war of railway timetables. For the first engagement of August 1914, about 2 million French were deployed on 4,278 trains and only 19 ran late. The wristwatch, which before the war had been considered effeminate, became a badge of masculine leadership. Synchronizing watches, then over-the-top style. Early in the war, Thomas Driston, the brother of Karen Bixton of Out of Africa fame, turned up at a recruiting office to enlist, only to be asked if he was a homosexual. The evidence of that he is wearing a wristwatch. He said he was not, and there was no further questions. In the United States, the same problem had been dealt with the rest of the world was troubling the individual states. Following the Civil War, railroad expansion had been prodigious. In the 40 years after 1860, by which year the US already had the world's largest railroad system, the amount of train track that had been laid down multiplied sixfold. By the turn of the century, nearly every town of any size had its own railway station, if not several. However, as in most of Europe, and the reckoning of the time was a local matter set by local noon, which at the latitude of New York is about 1 minute later than the clock. Each 11 miles one travels westward. Noon in New York was 11:55 a.m. In Philadelphia was 11:47 in Washington, 11:35 in Pittsburgh. Illinois used its 27 different time regions, Wisconsin's 38. There was 144 official times in North America, which you'd think most are in Illinois and Wisconsin then. And the traveler in 1870 going from the District of Columbia to San Francisco had to set his watch in every town through which he passed. Would have had to adjust it over 200 times. If a passenger wondered when he might arrive at his final destination, he had to know the time. That reminds me of the person who introduced the AM/PM. Now, why was he was, oh, he was a British engineer. I sort of remember it was 5:35 a.m. If a passenger wondered when he might arrive at his final destination, he had to know the time standard of the railroad that was taking them and make proper conversions to local times. Two cities set 100 miles apart maintained a 10-minute temporal separation, even though the train could cover the distance in less than 2 hours. So, which town was official? The train itself might set out from a city 500 miles away, so who owned the time? The towns along the route, the passenger, the railroad company? No wonder that Wilde noted that the chief occupation of typical American was catching trains. He visited the States in 1882. Now, it is interesting, I can remember that he died, 46. He died in 1900. One wonders how often he misses his connection. When people had travelled no faster than the speed of a horse, none of these considerations came into play. But a railway framed the economy, scheduling was a nightmare. As Braze writes, who is the historian of World War I, it was the slow increase of speed and power, the fusion of rails and steam, that undermined the standards of the horse and sail power, eventually the sun itself measuring time. That quotation comes from Blaze's biography of an enterprising 19th century Canadian Stanford Fleming. Now, he's the Stanford Fleming who used to say it. So I must have reread this, or it's not recorded, but I did hear the last section here. Continuing him to wait for 16 hours, so it was 5:35 p.m. where it was printed as an AM/PM. And wait for 16 hours. Why would it be condemning him to wait for 16 hours? Surely 12 hours would be the amount. Okay. Fleming was among other... Oh, because he missed that train. And there would be not another one the next time. Okay, that would be you. Was the chief engineer of the Canadian Railway, the Pacific Railway, and his monumental vexation at the delay inflamed the desire to the number of hours from 1 to 24. Why should the modern societies adhere to the anti-meridian and post-meridian? Why double count the hours, 1 to 12, twice a day? Hours ought to be considered hours in an ordinary sense, but simply 24 parts of the mean time occupied in the diurnal revolution of the earth. He would make his mission to bring about the 24-hour clock by which 7:35 p.m. would become 17:35 hours, or as we say, 100 hours in the army. On further reflection, he set himself a much greater task of relating all time zones worldwide to the relationship to longitude and the introduction of terrestrial local time. There's a footnote here. Written before the 24-hour clock had entered popular consciousness, the opening line of Orwell's 1984, it was a bright cold day in April and the clocks were striking 13. It was intended to make the British reader unused to the continental measurements feel uneasy. Standard Italian translations, clocks that strike 24 hours, having been commonplace in Italy from as early as the 14th century, runs, striking one. Okay, so I won't try and read you. Standard time was the best gauge in the world. It would convert celestial motion to civic time. By 1880, England had been the standard time for more than 30 years. A reform having started with the railways, why not America? Because US Congress, fearing a municipal uproar if the initiated change, had procrastinated, and the railroad industry, although well aware of the negative impact of the lack of standardization on its profits, did it too. From 1869 on, the question was debated until, at last, popular discontent forced the railroad baron's hand. On Saturday, the 18th of November, 1883, They bypassed Congress to adopt the Greenwich Mean Time system, dividing the country into four zones, Eastern, Central, Mountain, and Pacific, with noon falling an hour later in each. And that's interesting that the railways, the US government couldn't do it, the industries took it across. That day came to be known as the Sunday of Two Noons, since towns along the eastern edge of each new time belt had to turn the clock back half an hour, creating a second midday, in order to mesh with those closest to the western edge of the same belt. Within a few years, the system had become standard, but not with any considerable bitterness, and sometimes, such as Bangor, Maine, Savannah, Georgia, still would not cooperate, either from religious principle or stubbornness. Detroit, perched on the crack between the eastern and western central times, could not make its mind up, so that for many years, its inhabitants had to ascertain, in making an appointment, set solar, train, or city time. Congress itself did not ratify its standard time until it was forced to do by the war in 1918. So that's interesting. As the historian Mark Smith records, the telegraph, not the sun, now communicated the time to a temporarily unified nation. In the process, helped pave the way for the globalization of a deconceptualized world time. It's really interesting. Time is decontextualized. That's a beautiful thing. So many people were coming to accept the calendar, were to serve a practical global use. All dates had to be interpreted through the solar date line. Okay, here's a footnote. When the US state brought to Alaska in 1867, before standard time was implemented, the Russian Orthodox inhabitants found themselves suddenly having to observe the Sabbath on the Americans' Sunday, which was Monday, by Moscow's reckoning. They were forced to petition for guidance on when to celebrate Mass, on the Russian Monday or the American Sunday. The question was, that's interesting, there's still Russian Orthodox things for Americans. The question was, where would the date line be? In 1884, 25 countries sent representatives to a conference in Washington, D.C., 11 national meridians through Peter Ball, Rio, Lisbon, Tokyo, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Cadiz, Greenwich, Rome, Berlin, and Paris, as well as the additional contenders fixed on Jerusalem and the pyramids of Giza, Pisa, to honor Galileo, the National Observatory in Washington, and Azores, the original point of the definition of the age of exploration completed for primacy. French represented by their chief de mission, and by the great astronomer Jules César Janssen, were intransigent, insisting without much evidence that their lingua sacra was a better scientific choice. Fleming argued for national clocks set 180 degrees from Greenwich
in which the Middle Pacific, thus bypassing national sensibilities but still making use of Greenwich, though without involving England. But every longitudinal meridian touches the land at some point on this arc. And, in addition, where Fleming's solutions to be adopted, England would be split every noon between 2 days. This proposal soon floundered, and the debate ended only when Sir George Airy of Airy, Britain's irascible astronomer royal, wrote to the Prime Meridian, "It must be that Greenwich, for the navigation of most of the whole world, even then 90%, depends on calculations founded on Greenwich. France abstained from voting, and true to its delegates, defiance of Greenwich has never appeared on any of its charts. Surely, by pure coincidence, the anarchists who tried to blow up the observatory in 1894 was French." Okay. "As for the chosen site, once the vote came through, the meridian was moved to the famous obelisk at Pole Hill, a point 19 feet further east. The sundial thereby became banished. The sophisticated abstraction rose to take its place." And even that is wrong, apparently, because that position was wrong, because they were going off celestial coordinates, and the pom poms don't fall straight at Greenwich. Also in 1884, the Earth was sliced into 24 time zones, each an hour apart, with an eastbound traveller adding a successive hour, the westbound losing them. Of course, there was one moment which happens to confront us in the Western Pacific, when the logic of the system subtracts a day from eastbound travels and gives one to those heading west. Verne's Phileas Fogg learns with this just in time to win his bet around the world in 80 days. One by one, countries adopted the Greenwich Mean Time, even France in 1911. However, in 1972, the French, still unhappy with what they perceived as Britain's unjustified supremacy, carried a resolution in the United Nations to put GMT alongside Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, and to be relocated by a signal from Paris, naturally. While GMT is reckoned by the Earth's rotation and celestial measurements, UTC is set by cesium beam clock, which are less accurate but easier to consult. The point, in fact, the two systems are rarely more than a second apart, as UTS is argumented by leap seconds to compensate for the Earth's decelerating rotation. In Waiting for Godot, Poser asks the usual desperation, "What's the time?" His tramp companion's answer is not quite in unison. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. That all depends on the time of year. Those who thought the metal with the sun for their own purposes and pleasures were not finished. Daylight saving was next. And this project was dated back to Gentile Franklin in 1706-90. Who, on the 26th of April, 1784, when serving as US Minister to France, proposed an age of 78 with a moment of whimsy that Parisians conserve energy in form of candle wax and tallow by arising at the sun rather than sleeping with the shutters closed against the day. The idea never caught on, and more than a century would pass before it would find a receptive audience. Then, in July 1907, the successful London builder William Willett, 1875-15, a keen golfer and horseman, self-published The Waste of Daylight, in which he argued the more people should enjoy the early morning sunshine than as he did, and complained about how annoying it was to have to abandon a game of golf because of fading light. Might clocks be shifted forward or backwards by 20 minutes or on 4 successive weekends to make a change easier? I think 3 successive weekends. To make an hour. It was just it was a question for sports enthusiasts. Now there's a consult here. Okay. Everyone appreciates long light evenings. Everyone laments the shrinkage of the days grow shorter, and nearly everyone is given utterance to regret that the clear light of the early morning during the spring and summer months is so seldom seen or used. Scientists and astronomers were divided on the questions, although the press chirped, "Will chickens know what time to go to bed?" And the editors of Nature ridiculed the idea by equating the time with a change of artificial elevation of thermometer readings. So Nature's a pretty good magazine. Would it be more reasonable to change the reading of the thermometer at a particular season to alter the time of clock shown on the clock?
to increase the readings of the thermometer by 10 degrees during winter months, so that 30 degrees Fahrenheit shall read 42 degrees Fahrenheit. The temperature shall be called another. Just as easy as 2 a.m. can be expressed as 3 a.m., but the change in name is neither a case or cause of condition. So the difference here is that temperature is an experimental measurement, whereas the actual civil time is a declarative knowledge that everyone declares it. So I think that's a flawed logic. But Willett was not easily put off, and within 2 years, a daylight saving bill had been drafted, finally achieving passage as a wartime economy measure in 1916. Earlier that year, Germans had already passed such a law, hoping it would help them conserve fuel and allow factory workers on evening shifts to work without artificial light. Willett himself had died the previous years, but his neighbours erected a handsome memorial to him, a sundial positioned 3 hours in advance of time at any ordinary pace. In 1916, law was made permanent throughout Britain, and in 1925. America passed a similar law in 1916 too, but it proved too unpopular that Congress had to repeal it 3 years later. Farmers who measured, whom the measure was designed to help hated DST, daylight saving time, since they had to wake with the sun no matter what time their clock said, and were thus inconvenienced by having to change their schedule to sell their crops to people who observed the new system. Well, that's interesting. Then in 1936, President Harding issued an executive order mandating that all federal employees start at 8 a.m. rather than 9. Gee whiz, gosh, depression. Private employers could do as they pleased. The result was chaos, as some trains, buses, theatres, retailers shifted hours and hours. Not. Washington rebelled, deriding Harding's policy as a ragtime. After one summer of anarchy, he went back down. It wasn't until the Second World War that DST was adopted again, with only the governor of Oklahoma holding out. However, it was repealed with victory, and in the decades following, it remained in use in the US only by local option. Was particularly deranged results. 1 year, Iowa alone had 23 different DST systems. Jumped to 1965, and 71 of the largest American cities had adopted DST, 59 had not. Confusion reigns, particularly over transport routes, radio programs, business hours. The US Naval Observatory dubbed the country as the world's worst time keeper. The problem was finally resolved by the Uniform Time Act of 1966, although Indiana, most of Arizona, Hawaii still didn't observe DST. In 1996, the European Union, faced with a puzzle map of time zones, standardized DST, while in the US, as part of the energy policy of 2005, DST was extended to begin on the second Sunday of March instead of in April, and to the end on the Sunday of first Sunday of November. As of today, DST has been adopted by more than 1 billion people in about 70 countries, slightly less than 1/6 of the world's population. Okay. This shows you how much the world's population is increasing. When clocks move forward and backwards an hour, the body's clock, circadian rhythm, which governs the daylight, takes time to adjust. A study of 55,000 people, scientists found that 1 day's off work, subjects tended to sleep on standard, not daylight time. Like Robinson Crusoe notching a stick, the inhabitants of the gulag scratching a line for every day of their imprisonment remain enmeshed in time, unable to live alone. As recently as August 2007, Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, announced that, to improve the metabolism of his citizens, he had ordered the country's clocks to be moved forward half an hour, where the human brain is conditioned by sunlight, reversing the opposite decision made in 1965, but that aligns Venezuela with Afghanistan, India, Iran, Myanmar, all of which have offsets of half-hour increments from Greenwich Reckoning, including South Australia. I think we had a quarter-hour time at one place. Gail Collins, writing in the New York Times about Chavez's diktat, likened it to a scene in Woody Allen's film Bananas, I remember that one, in which a revolutionary hero becomes president of a South American country, and announces that from the day on, underwear will be worn on the outside. but Newfoundland is on the half-hour system, defying the rest of Canada, while Nepal is 15 minutes ahead of India. There is a 15 minutes time. Isn't that interesting? Nepal's 15 minutes ahead of India. But there's another there used to be, in the middle of the Australian desert, a 15-minute zone. I saw it on my map. I've never seen it before. 5 hours, 45 minutes ahead of Greenwich. Saudi Arabia supposedly has its clocks forward to midnight every day at sunset. As one commentator quipped, keeping one's watch properly attuned to the Rahed Ragoon Express and speed exhausting experience. Okay. Nor has the fine-tuning stopped there. A second used to be defined as one on something or other of a solar year. But nearly 60 years ago, now the National Physical Laboratory at Teddington invented the atomic clock, happily to discover that it was more accurate to base timekeeping. So, yeah, what's the second is the amount of time, is the amount of time it takes for, no, a meter is a 1/16 distance travelled by light, and light is so many, a certain decimal, sort of non-integer. It is an integer number of oscillations of a cesium clock, I'm pretty sure. It was, happily to discover that it was more accurate to base timekeeping on vibrating atoms than the orbiting Earth. It was slightly embarrassing, recalls David Rooney, curator of the timekeeping at the Royal Observatory. When clocks diverge, it isn't good. By the 1970s, we needed another fudge factor. So the leap second was introduced to push together the Earth rotation time and atomic vibration time. Such check-ins are not exerted every year. Decision to add or subtract, so far it's always been added, is made at the International Earth Rotation Service in Paris. The last assignation insertion was January 2006. It added an extra peep to the BBC time signal. It's now measuring precise time. It was the responsibility of agencies such as the US Naval Observatory in Washington D.C., the International Earth Rotation Service and Paris Observatory, and the Bureau International Reported Measures in Sèvres, France, all of which defined the second as, and this, read it, is 9,192,631,770 vibrations of radiation, a specified wavelength of cesium atom. I think it's just the wavelengths. The Sun has been officially deprived of its long-term role as timekeeper. This definition of a second, the first to be based not on the Earth's rotation around the Sun, but on the behaviour of atoms, was formally endorsed in 1967. But those leap seconds have periodically to be added to keep our clocks in sync with the planet's turnings, because the Earth is goes at its own pace, heedless of atomic time, to ensure that we can never run our clocks back to the Sun's guardianship. One can go fiddling almost indefinitely. The old joke that runs that even a stop clock is right twice a day. Like, was it Richelieu? That's the first time those clocks have been, have crashed, they've done something in synchronism. I want to read about Richelieu. I was found reading Voltaire really amazing. He was such an amazing man, Voltaire. Back in 1907, Einstein came up with the equivalence principle, which states that gravity is locally indistinguishable from acceleration, and diminishes as distance increases from the center of the mass, so that it goes, time goes faster, say at Santa Fe, up in New Mexico, than in Plough's Keeps, down low in New York, by a millisecond per century. Recent experiments in Westwood, round the world jet flights, slow clocks by 737 nanoseconds, which is about 2/3 of which were gravitational. Okay, well, that is interesting, because they were getting increased, they travelled at increased speed, so if they travelled eastbound, they would have actually slowed down. I wish I had that. A French clock made by the engineer Astronomer Passman exhibits a perpetual calendar, showing the date until 9,999. The Universal Lords, the ultimate timekeeper, watch based on a complex astronomical algorithm that provides local time, sunrise, sunset, moonrise, moonset, lunar phases, as well as digital analog military time wherever you are in AM, PM, in 2400 hour. It's programmed for 583 cities worldwide and automatically adjusts GST. Constructed titanium steel with sapphire crystals. Sapphire crystals are particularly hard and durable and easy to machine. So there was sea sapphire ball bearings in nuclear reactors. It offers the broadest interpretation of time that money can buy. It's purchased for $895. The Swiss watchmakers Swatch have proposed a planet-wide internet time that enables users throughout the world to bypass individual time zones and rendezvous at the same real time. Meanwhile, scientists who run clocks at Tennington, as well as competitors in the US and Japan, are at work at even more accurate machine known as the Iron Trap, which is due to be released by 2020. Experts say that if activated now and we're still running at the time predicted at the end of the universe, it might be wrong by half a second, if that, 20 times the accuracy of current and most advanced models. In 2006, the US suggested that the world time should be switched entirely to atomic clock, which would involve dropping the leap second, a notion that the British Royal Astronomy Society has up in arms. I think that's just bizarre. Had the proposal been accepted, says David Rooney, it would have been the first time in history that time was not dependent on the rising setting of the sun. Then is the order from the famous exchange of Godot, Waiting for Godot. That path of time, it would have passed anyway, said Escron. Let me hear different people. Okay, so sun in our pocket. I'll read this and get this published out and see if I can read on to chapter 22. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.